Today's episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Season 2 of the podcast Blowback. It's exclusively available on Stitcher Premium. Premium, after a critically acclaimed retelling of the Iraq War, Season 2 of Blowback, co-hosted by Brendan James and Noah Colwin. Brendan was on this program previewing Season 1 back in the day. Is a 10-part account of the unlikely story of the Cuban Revolution. It's a nuclear-tipped showdown between the Kennedy brothers, Fidel Castro, the Soviet Union, the CIA, and the Mafia. To listen now, get a free month of Stitcher Premium. Go to stitcher.com/premium and enter the promo code MAJORITY when you select a monthly plan. That's stitcher.com/premium, promo code MAJORITY. Now, let's start this show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, April 19th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Joshua Rothman, professor of history, University of Alabama, on The Ledger and the Chain, how domestic slave traders shaped America. Meanwhile, Joe Biden, pressured to raise the refugee cap, will raise it by less than one quarter of his campaign pledge. Now, with 3 million COVID deaths worldwide, over 50% of Americans have had at least their first vaccination. I should say American adults. Senate Democrats seem to be settling on a 25% corporate tax rate. And speaking of President Manchin, he has just come out and co-sponsored the PRO Act. That leaves three senators yet to co-sponsor the PRO Act, which is a threshold for it to be brought in the Senate. And while Marjorie Greene Taylor cancels her America First Nativist Caucus.
Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Whatever.
Okay.
Marjorie Taylor Greene. The Derek Chauvin trial closing arguments begin and end today. The program Save Our Stages has sat on $16 billion for almost 4 months. Meanwhile, Secretary of Interior Deb Haaland reverses a ton of Trump anti-environmental deregulations and creates a climate task force and a supposed self-driving Tesla car ends up killing its two occupants. And lastly, this is just breaking, the United Mine Workers have come out in favor of a just transition program away from mining coal. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Glad you could make it on this Monday, this very spring-like Monday.
It's beautiful
today. Emma Vigeland is here wearing a spring.
Sure. It's a spring shirt. It's very light. Like, I was hot walking to work, but now I'm cold again.
There you go.
So it's that kind of year when you can't decide, but I had a jacket on.
That time of year, yes.
Important stuff.
Indeed. And I'm wearing, of course, I'm in my spring garb as well, as you can see, which is very similar to my winter and my my fall outfit. But wait till summer comes, folks.
It's going to be a polo shirt, huh?
No, it's going to be a shirt like this, except for short sleeve.
Oh, okay. Casual Friday is when the polos.
Yeah, no, it's still going to be a hardish cover. Not exactly there it is. A couple of things. This was just late breaking. The United Mine Workers of America are coming out in favor of a just transition program. This is from the New York Times. The country's largest mine workers union signaled on Monday that it would accept a transition away from fossil fuels in exchange for new jobs in renewable energy and spending on technology to make coal cleaner and financial aid for miners who lose their jobs. This is a big part of the Green New Deal, frankly. The mine workers plan, which is going to be presented at an event with the Senator Joe Manchin, calls for the creation of new jobs in Appalachia through tax credits that would subsidize the making of solar panel and wind turbine components by funding the reclamation of abandoned mines that pose a risk to public health. That is good stuff. And so almost simultaneously, Joe Manchin signed on to the PRO Act as a co-sponsor.
Just minutes ago.
Yes, yeah, and I don't know if that was necessarily like tremendously unexpected, but he had been holding out. And now we have three, Kristen Sinema, Mark Kelly, and Mark Warner, who is sort of like skirts under the radar.
Yeah, I talk about how he's kind of just the dark horse of the centrist opposition to anything leftist. I mean, he represents a lot of the industries that are even more nefarious than Joe Manchin, who's more engaged in a personal branding exercise, as you put it, than Mark Warner, who is, I think, even more beholden to specific moneyed interests.
Yeah, I mean, it would appear so. And certainly Warner and Kelly got big money from Amazon, who we just saw a perfect example of right. of how a company like Amazon or Amazon can expend millions upon millions of dollars to prevent the unionization of its workers. One story in the BBC about a woman who had cancer was told by Amazon, if you get a union, we're taking away your health care. She, of course, didn't vote for the union. We recounted last week with the help of Rich Yselson that they expanded the size of the unit. They got to dictate what the unit was as to where what the union would organize.
Got it.
And so a PRO Act wouldn't necessarily have gotten you a union in Bessemer, but it would have made it much easier in a to unionize. And so it's when you look at a guy like Mark Warner or Mark Kelly, for that matter, you got to wonder, they got all that money from Amazon. Does that impact their vote when it comes to making it easier for workers to unionize in this country?
I think the answer might be yes.
It might be. It could also just be that, like, well, they were determined not to do it and they get that money anyways. And then the question is how much is that money worth relative to the pressure that they're going to get
exactly.
to vote the other way? So, but it's important you know that if that's one of your senators or if it's just someone that you didn't understand who they were, essentially. We should also say that the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union filed objections to the election with the National Labor Relations Board. And we will see how the National Labor Relations Board rules on these various objections. Don't know what the specifics ones were, but I imagine the drop box that was put on Amazon property, contrary to the ruling by the National Labor Relations Board, is going to be one of those things. Maybe things like telling a cancer patient that they're not going to have health insurance. Who knows? But we'll get more on that as it comes in. Mentioned earlier that both the defense and the prosecution are going to rest today in their final arguments in the Derek Chauvin case. Some of the images that maybe you saw of cops surrounding a church where there were protests in Brooklyn Center over the Dante Wright killing were really disturbing. And I don't know when we'll get a Derek Chauvin ruling, verdict, but I imagine it could be sometime this week. But of all the people weighing in on the various killings of unarmed black men, and in one instance, I think, I don't know if they had commented on this, a teenager, a boy. Here is Pat Robertson of the what's his show again?
I can't 700
Club. 700 Club.
It's inexplicably still on air. Yep. He is broadcasting still.
Yeah, God bless him. They're going to literally wheel him off that set.
Also, I'm going to say, I think a lot of people are thinking like I was, that both the gun and the taser would be put on your dominant side, but it's not that way.
They have to cross where they have them different.
So you actually have to reach across yourself.
You
know,
you feel the difference.
I mean, it's definitely
there's just no comparison. As I say, they're not making tasers in this yellow color anymore. They're making them in black. They're making them yellow. Now, how she made the
insane
difference
image.
She shot that poor guy to death, saying, "This is what I thought. This is what I thought was my taser." And if you can't tell the difference in the feel of those things, it's crazy. Anyhow, she deserves. But, I am pro-police, folks. I think we need the police. We need their servants, and they do a good job. But if they don't stop this onslaught, they cannot do this. You know, the police in Virginia picked up a lieutenant in the Army and began to give him trouble. And our state police are highly trained. But why they don't stop this? And this thing is going on in Minnesota. But the Derek Chauvin, I mean, they ought to put him under the jail. He has caused so much trouble by kneeling on the death of George Floyd. It's just, on his neck. It's just terrible what's happening. And the police, why don't they open their eyes to what the public relations are? They've got to stop this stuff.
Maybe they need more training.
Yeah, maybe more training. But the public relations seems to be his concern as he trails off. But the initial prop usage was to demonstrate how the weight, the feel, the grip, the different sides where they're holstered, it's entirely different. And an officer who's been in the force for over, 25 years, as she was, should be able to tell the difference. And if you've lost Pat Robertson on this issue, I mean, come on. It's got to be, there's something's got to give at some point.
Yeah, and I would say, I mean, look, there's two things about this clip. One is Pat Robertson, I think, maybe in that position now where he can sort of like almost see the pearly gates and realizes like, oh, wait a second. I may be taking a trip down instead of up.
I may have a legacy, yeah.
And so I might need to sort of, build some points and extra credits before I get into some type of judgment situation. But the what they inadvertently, I think, point out is that like you have all of these factors that this that would have prevented the cop from doing what she did, which is you got to reach across your body, that it's made out of yellow, that it feels different, that undoubtedly after 20 years, she's had a lot of training at this. The problem is one of two things, or maybe both things. One is there is no amount of training that ultimately is going to prevent this. The human humans are not capable of engaging in what they engage in, these police officers, apparently, regardless of the type of training. If you give them all these weapons, and on top of that, you give them a sense that when they see black people, they are necessarily in like some type of heightened state that they are looking at, you know, a potential enemy. And, you know, we've had many people, military personnel calling in going like, you know, like we don't have rules of engagement like that when we're at war. We're not allowed to fire at people unless they're actively firing at us. We're just not allowed to. And so the bottom line is like, you need to have a structural difference. You need to not put police officers in this situation, not necessarily for their sake, but not necessarily not for their sake. You need to just say like, no more traffic stops by armed officers. Just,
yeah.
There's no more opportunity for you to get arrested because your light is out on your car or your registration sticker is whatever. We're no longer using this as an opportunity, as like some massive fishing net that supposedly is keeping society safe, because there's no evidence that it keeps society safe. There's a lot of evidence that ends up with a lot of dead people, innocent people, or people, you know, who shouldn't be dead.
Yeah, and you heard at the end, the co-host suggests maybe they need more training. Okay, so that is now, this is a right-wing show. That is the right-wing position. So right. When you hear Joe Biden or anybody else in the Democratic Party suggest more training, understand that that's wildly insufficient. Structural changes are exactly what needs, what Sam's talking about. You know, changing
the structure. She was a trainer. She was a trainer.
Right. She was training officers at the time she did this, and she still didn't know the difference between her taser and her gun.
Right. And so, look, we have to continually narrow the scope of the responsibilities of police officers, period. And that's it. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Joshua D. Rothman. He is the professor of history and the chairman of the history department at the University of Alabama, author of The Ledger and the Chain, How Domestic Slave Traders Shaped America. We'll be right back after this. And, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about this. One of our sponsors today is Brooklinen. And this is exciting for them. It's springtime, right? World is still a little bit sideways, but spring, we have this idea of starting anew, right? Well, here's where Brooklinen comes in. Brooklinen is having a birthday sale, and it's happening this weekend. Brooklinen is offering site-wide savings on all things comfort for their biggest sale of the year. The reason why I saw this and I was a little bit, just a little bit off put was just, I literally just bought a new set of the core sheets.
Oh, you missed the.
I'm going to go back though, yeah. Because you can't have too many sheets as far as I'm concerned. But I bought, they had like limited edition red stripe. All my sheets are striped.
Yes, you are pro stripe.
I'm pro stripe. And I got the red stripe ones, and I got the, I've decided to like go with new pillows. For years, I've been using pillows that are like hard as a rock. I've actually had people who stayed over who laughed at me because of the pillows.
Or just said that they had a bad sleep because of
the pillows. No, they just like, what human being has pillows like this? And then I don't know why. I've come around. I've gotten new pillows. I got new pillows from Brooklinen. And why? Because working directly with the manufacturers, Brooklinen ensures premium, high-quality comfort every time at a fraction of the retail price. Brooklinen has ridiculously soft bedding, fantastic towels, and they have loungewear. They're so confident you're going to love everything. They have a 365-day warranty, and they've got 75,000 five-star reviews and counting. Very hard to argue with that, but don't listen to any of those reviews, folks, because I can tell you definitively. The bedding is tremendous. Pillows, sheets, towels have not got the loungewear. I have not because I just don't lounge.
Well, I want to purchase that loungewear.
It looks good, but I'm
a sucker for it.
I don't lounge. But I can tell you, all my betting has now been Brooklyn. It's been Brooklyn for a long time. But now I'm starting to like getting into a couple of different colors on the betting.
Hey.
Yep. You get everything you need for a spring refresh during Brooklinen's biggest sale of the year. Shop Brooklinen birthday sale starting this weekend. And if you're listening to this podcast after the sale ends, don't worry. You can still go to Brooklinen.com and use the promo code MajorityReport to get $20 off any purchase of $100 or more. Wow, that's awesome. That's Brooklinen, BROOKLINEN.com. Enter promo code MajorityReport to get $20 off any purchase of $100 or more. Brooklinen, everything you need to live your most comfortable life. All right, I'd like to welcome to the show Joshua D. Rothman. He is the professor of history at the University of Alabama, author of his most recent, The Ledger and the Chain, How Domestic Slave Traders Shaped America. Professor, I'm here with Emma Vigeland. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So let's start with 1808.
Okay.
This is when the United States banned the transcontinental slave trade, or the transatlantic, I guess I should say. What was behind that? And then what sort of dynamic did it create in this country that left it ripe for your protagonists?
Sure. So, you know, the transatlantic slave trade had gone on for several centuries by the time you get to the end of the 18th century. And in the Constitution, they make a provision that said Congress would not do anything about the transatlantic slave trade for 20 years after ratification. Everybody pretty much knew that after that 20 years expired, a ban would probably come into play. And the reasons for that are sort of complicated. In some measure, there's moral opposition to the transatlantic trade. But there are also these complicated economic and political considerations involved. Economically, for example, most states had actually either restricted or banned the transatlantic trade long before 1808. It was something that people thought had kind of outlived its usefulness. It was something that states of the Upper South realized that if there were no more imports of enslaved people, then they would be able to sell enslaved people who they already they were already in the country. And so when the ban comes down in 1808, you know, it's put in place at a time when people thought slavery might be losing momentum in the United States. But between 1788 and 1808, you get the invention of the cotton gin. You get the expansion of the nation into the West. You get the Louisiana Purchase. All of a sudden, cotton is the significantly much more profitable crop than people thought it was going to be in the 1780s. And so what Congress does is they institute the ban in 1808. But by doing that, of course, they effectively create a protective market for slave sales domestically. And so that creates opportunities for really a slave trade industry to develop domestically.
I had meant to, you know, I had contemplated this as I was reading through some of your work that, you know, maybe I need to just tell people this is going to be sort of a disturbing conversation in some respects, because honestly, because like some of the, and particularly when we get into some of these slave traders that you write about talking about women, like the point of what you've written is to show how sort of brutal these slave traders and dehumanizing so we're going to be talking about enslaved people as just like pure commodities here. And I mean, I guess that is the point. So with that said, and that sort of limit on how many enslaved people are going to be in the country at that point, which in almost necessarily means like, okay, there's a finite amount of enslaved people. Their value starts to rise once the demand starts to kick up with cotton. When we look back on this era, before we go forward, what are the myths that you that in many respects, I think you wrote this to dispel.
So, you know, there are a lot of myths about the domestic slave trade and about slave traders that have really carried on since starting really before the Civil War. They really kick in even afterward with they become sort of part of the mythology of the Lost Cause. I think there are probably several big myths that are worth dispelling. One is simply the scale of the domestic trade. One of the things that white Southerners often said before the Civil War was that slave sales were rare. They were something that slaveholders really only turned to as a last resort, reluctantly, when they had no other choice. If you actually look at the domestic slave trade, it's simply not true. I mean, it's just a lie. Slave sales happened all the time in the United States. They don't simply happen when slaveholders feel like they have no choice. They happen when slaveholders feel like they have different kinds of calculations they're making about their labor force, about their finances. Enslaved families are separated routinely. I mean, somebody did a calculation on this in the 70s and calculated that essentially one enslaved person was sold somewhere in the United States every 3.5 minutes for decades. So that's one myth, is that the slave trade was something sort of off to the side and kind of uncommon. A second important one, I think, has to do with slave traders themselves. And this was something that white slaveholders said all the time, which was that, sure, the slave trade does happen sometimes, but that the people who are really responsible for that are the traders. Traders are sort of these lowlifes, the kind of the dregs of humanity. Nobody really likes dealing with them. And if you had to deal with them, you would certainly only do it in a business setting. You would never socialize with a slave trader. The idea was that they were sort of a necessary evil, right? Kind of social outcasts. But if you actually look at slave traders and at their status in the United States, again, that simply doesn't seem to be true. It's easy to say that you disdained people who were kind of fly-by-night operators, right? They might show up somewhere with people to sell. You never knew where they came from. And when they sold people, then they disappeared. You never knew where they were. But a lot of slave traders are not like that. They're not necessarily itinerants. They're established business people in cities and towns all over the country. They are respected business people. They have relationships with politicians and merchants and banks and slaveholders. They, even after they get out of the trade, they marry into respectable families. They run for public office. They sometimes go into other businesses, so they might run you know, they might run hotels or get involved with banks themselves, things like that. So really the idea that the slave trade and that slave traders are somehow, you know, they're kind of not really part of what made slavery and what made the American economy worked. If you actually look at the evidence, those things simply aren't true.
But there seems to be such a cognitive dissonance there. I mean, to put it mildly, like there's no moral difference to me looking at it now between owning slaves and participating in slave trading. You know, what, how was that separated in people's minds during this time, and why was one seen more unseemly than the other? Was it just because owning slaves was so integral to the United States economy?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And there is some cognitive dissonance there, and it was and you're right. I mean, in some ways, I think what you need to realize is that essentially every slave owner at some point is a slave trader. Almost every slaveholder at some point is going to engage in the buying and selling of enslaved people. So, you know, we look at it today and we say, well, what's really the difference, right? The slave trade is not only something that happens because slave traders do it. It happens because it's everywhere. And that is certainly true. But part of the mythology is slaveholders telling themselves that their involvement in slavery was really about paternalism. There's a mythology of paternalism that infuses ideas about slaveholding, where slaveholders could tell themselves that, you know, that by owning enslaved people, they were sort of improving their situations. They were making better Christians out of them, that they took care of them. They made sure that their families were not separated in the market. Again, the cognitive dissonance is a way of displacing what they told themselves were the worst elements of slavery onto a different class of people. But in fact, you're absolutely right. If you actually look at the way slavery operated, there's no sort of good side of slavery and bad side of slavery. There's just slavery. And the worst elements of slavery were always there. They're omnipresent in enslaved people's lives. But this was a story that slaveholders told themselves, and the ideas that they advanced about what the slave trade was were part of that story.
It's almost as if they want to play it off like, I've just adopted somebody. And, they're just now, I'm their guardian now, as opposed to I've purchased this person. And if it suits me in the marketplace, I'll go back in and sell it at a profit.
I mean, there's really a way in which they're trying to tell themselves that slavery is not nearly as profit oriented and nakedly exploitative as it actually is.
All right, so let's go some of the characters that you focus on to tell this story. And I should also say too that I learned that by 1863, I think it was, or just right before the Civil War, the value of enslaved people was greater than the nation's investment in railroads, banks, and manufacturing put together.
Put together, yeah, that's true.
When we talk about, like, the questions of infrastructure today, when we talk about the bill, like the idea that, like, people could be part of infrastructure. That's what the first 100 years of our country was, just exclusively, it seems like, the biggest element of our infrastructure, of our economy, was enslaved people.
Enslaved people are an enormous asset class before the Civil War. I mean, like you said before, it is disturbing and really troubling to even think about people in those terms, nonetheless talk about them in those terms. But that, enslaved people, we often think of them as, to the extent we think about slavery and enslaved people, what their function was in American society, we think of them as a labor force. It's not simply as a labor force. They are obviously a labor force that creates, that is producing cotton, which is the largest export the United States had before the Civil War. But they're also an investment for lots of people. They could be mortgaged. They could be leveraged. They could be sort of the underpinning of state bonds for banks. And so they are financialized as well. The financial value is enormous in addition to the labor value.
So let's start with Austin Woolfolk in Baltimore. Who was he, and what part does he play in this story?
So Austin Woolfolk is in some ways sort of the pioneer for what the people that I really write about would then do. Austin Woolfolk was a slave trader based in Baltimore. He is particularly active in the late 18-teens and into the 1820s. And he and a number of brothers and cousins, these businesses were often family operations, as a lot of businesses were in the early Republic. And he is really one of the first traders to create a big business by shipping people by boat along the coast from the upper South to the lower South. So he is sending hundreds of people at a time from Baltimore, first to Georgia, then over to New Orleans. He has a regular office set up in Baltimore. He is really sort of the leading slave trader in the United States in the 1820s. If you read some of the autobiographical stuff of Frederick Douglass talked about how, Frederick Douglass was born and raised in Maryland, and really talked about how Austin Woolfolk was the kind of person who really was a terror to enslaved people everywhere in Maryland, whether they actually came across him or not. They always knew that the prospect of being sold to Austin Woolfolk was a possibility.
And then, Wolfolk ended up being, was he a direct inspiration? I mean, so when we get into talking about Isaac Franklin and John Armfield and Rice Ballard, did they see what Wolfolk was doing and saying, we can innovate in this area, essentially?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So Franklin and Armfield, when they kind of get into, and they get into the slave trade at different points in time and different points in their lives, but they are really starting to get involved in Northern Virginia, particularly in the city of Alexandria. And you couldn't avoid Austin Wolfolk in those places. Everybody knew that he was the major player in the region. And when you see as they start to develop their business, it's very clear that the kind of model that they are working from is the model that Austin Wolfolk had pioneered. Now, there's no actual sort of, you know, letter that survived where they say, you know, we're gonna do what Wolfolk did, but we're going to do it bigger and better. But that really is effectively what they did. If you take a look at the way that they designed their business model, it really is taking a lot of the techniques that Wolfolk did and making them even larger, making them even more expansive. You know, they, for example, they don't go into Baltimore at the very beginning because they realized that trying to compete head to head with him was impossible. So they try to set up a kind of parallel business in Northern Virginia. And then eventually that business gets so big that they actually pretty much put Wolfolk out of business.
So, I mean, what were some of their I guess, innovations? I mean, like, you know, what did they do? They started to go. I mean, they realized that there was a trade here. It sounds like to a certain extent that they said, we can actually we can develop the market as opposed to just sort of serve it.
Yeah. So a number of things that they do, and again, a few of these things are things that Wolfolk did, right? One thing they do, for example, is they establish a headquarters, a kind of regular office. A lot of slave traders before Austin Wolfolk, and then even continuing past the Wolfolk era, these were men who worked out of taverns, bars, hotels. They don't have a kind of regular place of business. The taverns and hotels were the kinds of places where people did all sorts of business. So they set up shop there. Wolfolk had a regular, had offices in a house. And he had a private jail that was connected to the house. And so Franklin and Armfield basically do the same thing. They rent this three-story townhouse in Alexandria. It's attached to an enormous compound out in the back where you could put several hundred enslaved people at a time. Franklin has a sales end of the business down in Natchez, Mississippi, and then in New Orleans. Eventually, they're running sales out of both cities. So that's one thing they do, is they create an official headquarters, right? So you knew that this wasn't a fly by night operation. This was really a kind of regular place of business with regular businessmen. Another thing they do is they expand on the shipping element of things. We often think of the domestic slave trade as working mostly over land. Everybody's sort of seen images of people being walked in long lines, in handcuffs, in these caravans that were known as coffles. Franklin and Armfield did do that sometimes, but what Wolfolk really demonstrated was you could, if you were willing to pay a little more up front, you could cut the time involved of getting people from the upper South to the lower South in half. Maybe even more than in half if you send people by ship instead. And so Franklin and Armfield do that. And not only do they send people by ship, eventually they buy their own ships. They have a small fleet of company vessels that they use. And at the peak of their business, they have a ship at sea somewhere almost every single day. They are sending loads of people at the peak, basically every 2 weeks, a shipment of people is leaving Alexandria for New Orleans. So that's a second thing that they do. But really what makes them kind of most successful and that really is able to kind of put them at the top of their industry is, you know, Isaac Franklin had been working in the slave trade practically since 1808. So by the time Franklin and Armfield is founded in 1828, he's been in the business for 20 years. He's developed all kinds of relationships with merchants and with bankers in the lower South. And what he realizes is that if you were willing to run your business more on credit than on cash, because most slave traders, it's a cash business. Franklin liked cash. All slave traders liked cash. But he realized that if he could tap into credit lines from banks and have a lot of money at his disposal, then he could afford also to sell enslaved people on credit more than most slave traders did. And a lot of slaveholders and prospective customers, they love being able to buy out credit. They love being able to have the person in their custody and then pay them off over time. So what Franklin and Armfield are able to do is they're able to make their business so big, not simply because they had so much cash on hand, but because they have access to enormous amounts of credit that they have flowing at any given time. And so they've got this kind of constant motion of money for enslaved people. And being tapped into those networks really better than anyone else is really what sets them apart and makes them so successful.
Are these innovations specific to, they're basically, they've turned slaves into essentially like, machines that you would buy, machinery, right? I mean, that's the way that, you know, manufacturers will buy machinery is I'll buy it on a loan and I'll pay it off over, you know, as to what the machines produce, essentially. Was this new to slavery, or was it simply like also a financial innovation that was sort of new to the world of capitalism, right? I mean, like this is the develop. We're watching almost on some level too the development of capitalism here.
Yeah, I mean, look, what Franklin and Armfield are doing, right? I wouldn't say that slave traders and people like Franklin and Armfield are pioneering the idea of the way their credit operations run, right? This is something that's parallel in a lot of industries across the United States and really across the Western world as part of the early Industrial Revolution and the way businesses are running. But it's the application of it to slavery and the trade in enslaved people. That's what's really different about Franklin and Armfield in particular. And obviously, they're not the only slave traders who do this. They weren't even necessarily the first slave traders to do it. They're just people who do it a lot better than anyone else of their era.
What banks, and are some of these banks still in existence today, were most kind of integral to this credit system with slave traders? Because, you know, a lot of this is whitewashed from the history of institutions like, say, J.P. Morgan Chase or whatever. I'm not sure when that came into existence. But
I actually have not traced the genealogy of the banks that they worked with and tried to figure out, you know, none of them have survived directly.
Right.
You won't find any names of any of the banks they work with and say this is the exact same bank then as it is now. Banks come and go, particularly in the era they worked in the 1830s. There's a lot of enormous amounts of money flooding into the banking sector in the United States, which also contributes to why they're so successful. Right. There's a timing issue here. Economic panics and depressions come around that wipe banks out. And so banks could kind of come and go in this era. Probably the most famous bank that they worked with, though, is the Second Bank of the United States. It's the bank that holds all the money of the federal government. And essentially what you have going on there is, the money of the federal government before the Civil War mostly comes from a couple of places. It comes from customs, or it comes from selling Indian land. So basically the process that's happening here is the federal government is displacing and dispossessing Indian nations in the Southeast. They're turning around and selling that land to white cotton farmers and pulling the money into the federal treasury. And then they're putting that money into investments, especially in the South and Southwest, which then goes to buy enslaved people. So it's this cycle where the way in which that sector of the economy is predicated on these kind of multiple levels of exploitation and expropriation. It's kind of remarkable when you sort of lay it out like that, because it's the complexities of money are very complicated, but the actual sort of process of what's going on here, when you boil it down to it, it's pretty straightforward, and it's pretty awful.
Awful. I just want to examine that cycle a little bit, and also, you know, sort of set the context in terms of timing, right? You have Jackson is clearing clearing. I mean, he's killing Native Americans, basically, like you say, dispossessing them of that land. So that's function A of the U.S. government in sort of like creating this cycle, I guess, or this sort of the system, which then allows for cotton to be grown there, and then they finance the mechanism to do the slave trade, which is going to provide the labor to pick that cotton. So we have sort of like multiple subsidies of this whole process going through this, that the American government is just sort of making it work. And this dynamic on some level is also like, it's the same dynamic of imperialism on some level, right? I mean, just broadly speaking, we're doing that. We just happen to be doing it domestically, or considering it domestic, because it's contiguous to land that we're taking from other people anyways.
Yeah, sure. And this really is part of the expansion of an American empire, right? It happens first with the Louisiana Purchase, then it continues to happen in the War of 1812, then it continues to happen in the Age of Jackson. And of course, following the Age of Jackson, then it happens in Texas, right? And you get the Mexican War. And that is sort of the kind of the next stage of American imperialism. And the truth is that by the time you got to the 1850s, you had a sizable number of Southern slaveholders and Southern politicians who really imagine a kind of hemispheric empire of slavery. They have their eyes particularly on places like Cuba as places that might be taken and attached to the United States. They imagine that there could be places in Central and South America where slavery could continue to expand. So what you're seeing here in the 1820s and 1830s is not the first stage of the process, but it is one stage of this process of the growth of an American empire. Absolutely.
And let's talk just a little bit about the process of building, because now we have a finite number of enslaved people in the country, except for as people are being born into slavery, I guess, sure, as well. And maybe you can help us with, you know, what kind of numbers that is in terms of building the enslaved population. But these guys, Franklin and Armfield, also go around and essentially purchase slaves. And then there's some type of arbitrage that goes on. It's almost like house flipping on some level. They warehouse the slaves. They literally fatten them up. Will you talk about that process of like how they sort of, you know, get their slaves ready to be sold after, and how they find them?
Sure. So, like I said, you know, John Armfield has this townhouse as a headquarters that he's got in Alexandria. But of course, he can't be in all places at once, right? He is sometimes, you know, in his offices in Alexandria. Sometimes he is out in town or in the ditch elsewhere in the District of Columbia. And bear in mind that the city of Alexandria at this point is part of the District of Columbia, right? So this is also part of the reason they draw so much attention, is they are right in the nation's capital, right across the Potomac River from Washington, D.C. And in order to kind of maximize the number of enslaved people the company can purchase, they have agents, employees of the firm who are often working on commission. And they are scattered out across Maryland and Northern Virginia. Eventually, they're in Baltimore. They're up and down the Eastern Shore of Maryland. They're out in the city of Frederick. They're in the city of Warrenton, Virginia. They station Rice Ballard in the city of Richmond. And Richmond is becoming itself a really important node for the domestic slave trade by the 1830s, and becomes even more so later in the era. And essentially what they're doing, you can imagine kind of Armfield and Alexandria as sort of the center of a circle. Kind of the way I describe it in the book is they're sort of spokes on a wheel. And all of these agents are funneling people to Alexandria. Armfield will, as you say, sort of stockpile people in the compound in Alexandria. He will then put them on a boat when he has enough people and the time is right. The ship will then sail down the Potomac from Alexandria out into the Chesapeake Bay. It will stop in Norfolk, where Ballard is sending people from Richmond down the James River to Norfolk. So they'll load more people in Norfolk. When the boat is full, they then send it down the Atlantic coast, around Florida, up into the Gulf of Mexico to New Orleans. Franklin will then pick people up in New Orleans. Some people he's selling in New Orleans. Other people he's putting on a steamboat and sending up to Natchez, Mississippi, which is sort of the is on the Mississippi River and is really a kind of major hub of the cotton trade in Mississippi, and really in Mississippi, eastern Louisiana as well. And then once you get people to Natchez, right, by this point, this is a trip that's taken about 3 weeks to get from Alexandria to New Orleans. It's the standard voyage is 19 days, but it could take a little bit longer than that. It's about 3 weeks. You're on this boat. By night, you are locked below decks like you would be in the transatlantic slave trade. By day, you're often sort of led out onto the deck. But nonetheless, by the time you get there, you're exhausted. You've been wearing the same clothes for 3 weeks. You're filthy. The kind of rations that you're going to get aboard a ship, I mean, even under the best of conditions, are not going to be great. So what would happen then is Franklin would receive the people that Armfield had sent him. He would make sure that they got themselves cleaned up. Armfield always sent new clothing from Alexandria. They have a tailor shop in Alexandria where they actually make the clothing. So they're given new clothing. They're given some decent food. They're cleaned up, and they're basically made to look as healthy and as strong as possible. So that when customers came, they believed that they could kind of project what they would be getting when they purchased a particular person. And sometimes that means somebody is marketed as field labor. Sometimes it's marketing people with particular skills, right? They'd say this person is a cook, this person is a blacksmith, this person is a carpenter, and you can sell people for a premium that way. And basically Franklin and Armfield are kind of making their difference, making their money on the difference between what they could purchase people for and what they could sell people for. Added on top of that, of course, is any interest that Franklin would get if the people were being sold on credit. And his sort of standard interest rate was about 10% per year.
And we should say, like, they would use wax to fill in marks from being whipped. They would dye folks' hair.
Those were pretty standard practices in the slave trade. Yeah. Now whipping scars, really, there's only so much you can do to disguise that. But what Franklin would have to do is he'd have to know, okay, look, you know, if I'm gonna sell this person, I have to be able to come up with some sort of life story to explain this, right? And you had to explain away sort of marks of torture like that. There's only so much disguising of those sorts of things that you could do. But yes, things like dyeing people's hair and things like that, those were pretty standard practices.
So we don't have much time, but why do you think that this has been? And I could ask this question about Reconstruction, and I feel like we could ask this question about, the Lost Cause as well. But why has this been this history so erased? I mean, these guys were effectively billionaires. They were the billionaires of their time. They didn't literally have $1 billion, but it would have been close, I think, in today's value. They
were, well, yeah, I mean, hundreds of millions. If you sort of estimate their fortune relative to kind of what GDP is now, yeah, I mean, it would have been hundreds of millions. Yeah,
and they are completely, as you write, like immersed in high society. They're not ostracized in any way. Why is it so erased from history?
I think there are lots of complicated reasons for why that would be, but the shortest version of that, of the answer to that question, I think, is because the myths have been very successful in taking hold, and it is related to the Lost Cause. The idea that that slavery maybe wasn't so bad as we thought it was. The idea that that slavery and capitalism were not as integrally connected as a lot of historians are coming to kind of re-examine. I mean, this is not new, right? Things about slavery and capitalism are things people have been talking about on and off for a century. There are historians looking at that in new ways in the last 10 or 15 years, but the idea itself is not new. But I think it's the kind of story that it doesn't flatter the nation. And Americans, and we are not the only people who do this, but I think Americans in particular really like stories that flatter the nation and flatter themselves. And you can't tell this story in a way that is flattering to the way the United States developed. And it's one of those things that is easier to bury than it is to deal with.
It's fascinating. These two primary figures you're talking about, Armfield and Franklin, have no, at least white descendants.
No direct white descendants. That's true.
So there's really, it's what of his of their relatives and there and they had one. Did they have one direct black descendant?
So each of both Franklin and Armfield had at least one, child with an enslaved woman that I know of. It's distinctly possible there are more. Rice Ballard had at least one, and probably more as well. I believe that Rice Ballard does have direct white descendants. I have not met them. I have met several of the descendants of sort of relatives of Franklin and Armfield. Armfield, for example, raised several of Isaac Franklin's nieces and nephews effectively as his own children. And some of their descendants are still alive, and I've met with them. And you know, you'd have to ask them how they feel about, you know, being on the receiving end of this sort of story.
Is the money there, though? I mean, I'm curious as to what that money's doing now.
Yeah, the money is, you know, I haven't asked them, are you rich? that's not really the kind of thing that I've gotten into with them. I think really, you know, the money is in some way still there, probably in certain family fortunes. If you were able to sort of trace it down, it's probably still there in some places. But to me, what's really more interesting and more significant than what particular family fortunes did these activities endow, it's really that the money of the slave trade, you know, where is it now? It's everywhere now. All of those people who were bought and sold and used to produce cotton, all of the kind of ways in which their value as assets was leveraged for the larger good of hundreds of thousands of individual people and the nation as a whole, all of that money is still diffused throughout the American economy. We're still living on the other end of it now.
Joshua D. Rothman, professor of history, University of Alabama. The book is The Ledger and the Chain, How Domestic Slave Traders Shaped America. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
All right, going to take a quick break. We will put a link to that book at majority.fm. We'll be right back after this. All right, folks, that's about it for us today. Disturbing stuff. And the we didn't even get into the some of the most disturbing stuff about the perspective those slave traders had in terms of, essentially enslaved women that they would, were raping, and the way that they would discuss them with other people. It was just... nothing that is in some ways unsurprising, but the
justification,
you just don't hear much about.
Yeah,
it.
Yeah, you don't really hear, I guess, about the psychology behind it and how socially they justified it to themselves,
right,
within society. Yeah,
completely seamless in the way it was integrated into these societies. All right, folks, that's it for us today. For Emma and I, we will see you tomorrow. And for some of you, we will see you to now.
That was new.
That's new.
Yeah.
I made it up.
Well done.
Thank you. That was my accomplishment for the day.
Not really, though.
I'm going to, now I can go take a nap. No, we're heading into the fun half, ladies and gentlemen, wherein we will take your phone calls and your IMs, and we will go over some sound clips and audio and video clips and talk about different things. You can support this show by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the free show, free of commercials, and you keep the free show alive, and then you get some extra content afterwards, which is the fun half. So head over to jointhemajorityreport.com right now. Support this program, if you will. And if you cannot afford the fun half, but you want it, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Have patience with us. Sometimes a couple of emails fall through the cracks. Sometimes it takes weeks upon weeks to get back to you. But if you haven't heard from us and you sent us an email, send us another one, majorityreporters@gmail.com, and put in the subject line, fun half, fun half. And we will get to you ASAP. Just put fun half. Don't put fun half ASAP. Just fun half. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And the AM Quickie. If you can't catch this show during the day, check out the AM Quickie, amquickie.com. You get the news of the day in about 6-7 minutes, right in podcast form. You can also watch on YouTube, too, at Majority Report Audio. Yes, I know. There's a lot of people IMing me already about Dimmy Jore and his. He's on like some type of like book tour or something right now.
All he knows these, how to write?
Well, like a book tour.
Sorry. Don't care.
He read one.
That's shocking.
He's on a book tour telling people they read it.
Doesn't read articles, but reads books.
Folks, don't forget to check out Nomi's show. She starts her week tomorrow, but plenty of good content to check out there from last week. YouTube.com/TheNomaKey Show or Twitch.tv/TheNomaKey_Show. And Matt, what's happening in the Leckian media universe?
Yeah, well, per today's interview, people should check out the most recent Literary Hangover episode on William Byrd's diary for 1710. There's a little exchange that starts in May of 26, where he says, "I said my prayers and ate milk and strawberries with Captain Possford for breakfast. He told me that a ship was arrived with Negroes and offered his service to fetch my wine from Williamsburg. 5 days later, in the evening, I took a walk and met the new Negroes, which Mr. Bland had bought for me to the number of 26 for 23 pounds apiece. The next day, in the evening, I did not walk because of my company. Robin Hicks asked me to pay 70 pounds for two Negroes, which he intended to buy of John Evans, which I agreed in hoping of gaining the trade." So you see, immediately turned into a commodity that he sells for profit. Just that's how it worked.
It's like, it's disgusting to talk about it in this way, but it basically was like, you know, flip this house type of situation.
100%. Yep.
Really fascinating, gross, and important. You know, I mean, this history completely submerged so that we can, you know, maintain these myths that get deployed all the time.
It wasn't Thomas Jefferson riding around his plantation on his horse doing like enlightenment experiments.
No. All right, folks, 646-257-3920 is the number. We will see you in the fun half.